is it about this piece of music that actually calms me down? Artie Shaw, Begin to Begin. And each Wednesday, I feel like we're beginning to begin all over again. Good evening, Jeffrey Bennett. To health with you. Or your health, your choices, your life. Glad to be here. It's the 8th day of November. I've got my strength back. Oh, yesterday was something else. Oh my God. And yeah. I'm going to share something with you tonight that I know I've shared in the past. And yet it's somewhat paramount because of direction I'm going to take this program throughout the hour. Winston Churchill once said that men occasionally stumble over the truth, but most pick themselves up and hurry off as if nothing happened. Kimberly Kelly, one of Dr. Kelly's children. I met Kimberly some years ago. We got along, but we didn't get along. A lot that I was involved with her father that she didn't fully understand. We had dinner a couple of times. I was in Texas at the time, doing a lot of catch-up with the Kelly people, the family, the estate, a lot of things going on. Kimberly, back in 1985, wrote a phenomenal piece describing her father, what she went through growing up with him. William D. Kelly, DDS. That's what she put in the space marked father on the hundreds of forms that she had to fill out in her time. In the space marked father's occupation, she wrote the words health researcher. She said that was about all the information I volunteered without a darn good reason, though. To my frequent embarrassment, my father has managed to attain a certain degree of fame. Euphemistically, he could be said to be controversial. Those less kindly disposed toward him might use the term infamous. In any case, Kimberly always found it easier simply to avoid him as a topic of casual conversation. She said, when we lived in tiny Grapevine, Texas, everyone in town knew my father. He was the dentist in the little yellow office on Worth Street who didn't appear to be practicing dentistry. His patients didn't come from across town. They flew in from across the country. And the people coming to see him were all so desperately ill. Many of them were cancer patients, obviously on their last legs. Just what was going on in that small little office? The Fort Worth Star-Telegram answered that question in a shocking expose which set the town ablaze. Kelly, an orthodontist, was seeing cancer patients. And further, the therapy he suggested was largely a matter of altering the diets of his patients and giving them vitamins and such. I mean, the notion that an individual's diet might be a factor in a disease as serious as cancer was considered absurd. But only slightly less so than the idea of a dentist working with cancer patients in any capacity. Now, the scandal instigated by that which we're sharing with you today, that was the first that she remembered. Unfortunately, it was not the last. Her father, William Donald Kelly, became involved in cancer research first as a patient. In the early 1960s, life in the family was relatively normal. At that time, they lived in Midland, the tumbleweed capital of Texas. Her father was practicing orthodontics. His practice was thriving. He belonged to the local country club, the school board, the Church of Christ. And in his spare time, he indulged his passion for tinkering by restoring antique cars. His pride and joy was named Twinkles. a 1923 Cadillac that ran like a top in response to his diligent and loving care. She said, I'd like to think that my father, given a choice, would not have changed much in his life. However, he was not given that option. Dad became ill in 1963, she said, critically so by 1967. And the physicians he saw in Midland and Odessa could not find anything physiologically wrong with him for quite some time. The fact that he was ill was undeniably apparent. He was so weak, he found it necessary to lie down at the office between seeing patients. And after he suffered what appeared to be two heart attacks, a diagnosis was finally made. The situation, she had been told, was as follows. He had cancer of the pancreas and liver. And as is usually the case, the malignancy was in its final stages at the time of diagnosis. The doctor refused to operate, saying Dad would die on the table, that he should get his affairs in order quickly. He could expect to live only a few months. The doctor took Kelly's wife aside to tell her that. And in his opinion, 2 months was a more realistic time frame. One of the many reasons cancer is such an effective killer, Kelly continues, is its ability to destroy completely the individual's will to live. The patient suffers overwhelming pain, and his prognosis is rarely very optimistic. Any strength one might possess to combat the disease is soon exhausted, and death ceases to be viewed as something to be avoided. For in death, the pain will be gone. The patient will no longer be forced to face the people he loves and sorrow his, and the sorrow he's suffering has brought them. Death becomes a friend, not an adversary. Kelly's mother and grandmother, Kelly, had told her stories of how terrible a thing it was to watch. I knew Kelly's mother. She's a marvelous woman. She passed away some years ago. Kelly continues that unfortunately, or very fortunately, her mother had some more unpleasant news for him. Now, her mother always had this real talent with a credit card. And due to the fact that they were living heavily in debt, she had quietly allowed Dad's life insurance to lapse. And his death would leave the wife and the three young daughters destitute. She imagined Dad was pretty angry. He'd come to terms with dying, but this news surely obliterated any peace of mind he might have attained. And at some point, he made a decision to do whatever he could to live. I don't know from what source he found the strength to attempt the impossible, she continued. Maybe his anger provided the motivation. After all, if he had died, he wouldn't have been able to kill her mom, his wife. Well, instead of tinkering with Twinkles, Dad now began tinkering with himself. The doctors had offered him no hope, no help. His only option was to take his case into his own hands. And he wasn't overly armed for the fight. One of his degrees was in biochemistry, and he knew of several people conducting innovative research in natural healing. His illness was so severe that by trial and error, he was able to determine quickly what substances, what food, vitamins, and/or minerals swung the pendulum of his well-being and in what direction. Virtually everything the rest of the family ate would make him wretchedly ill. She remembers sitting down to fried chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy while Dad dined on vile-smelling liver. And her sisters and Kelly didn't understand why he was eating this way. No one told us. No one told the girls that he was dying. Well, anyway, Dad must have been something right. 2 months came and went. The next four followed suit. During that time, and for some time after, to be sure, Dad was critically ill. And for the purposes of this paper that I'm sharing with you tonight, my friends, and its space limitation, Kelly said she had greatly simplified the things he did to get well, but the bottom line is still the same. He did not die. Now, allow me to interject for just a moment that several months ago, I think going back to what, June, July, we ran a very intense four-part series, which had been written by Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who at one time became a student of Dr. Kelly's. Gonzalez passed away in 2015 of still unspecified reasons. There's certainly thoughts as to why he passed. He and 76 other alternative doctors around the country. But in that four-part series, which is still can be heard on our archives, it's profound. One of the things that we began to learn is that Dr. Kelly's mother had gotten very deeply involved with getting him on the right kind of diet. Oh, she cracked the whip. Boy, did she ever. Well, with all this going on, word got around. And boy, did it get around. The parents of her father's orthodontic patients began asking him for advice about their ills and those of their loved ones. She said her father naively dispensed it. She said, I don't believe it ever occurred to him to do otherwise. Many of those asking his advice were friends or at least people he knew. Simply told him what he had done to help himself. He had been there and knew firsthand the agony a cancer patient experiences. So here were people in desperate need of help. If he knew something that might ease their pain at all, he felt it was his moral duty to tell them, and many of those who did what he said got well. And the word began to get out. People came to see Dr. Kelly in increasing numbers. Well, they weren't looking to have braces put on their kids' teeth. And since he had to earn a living for his family, but still felt a moral obligation to help anyone he could, he wrote a slim little booklet in 1969 called One Answer to Cancer. I have a copy of that original 1969 book. I actually sent several copies to my friend Dr. Fred down in Indiana. This little booklet was the story of his personal encounter with malignancy and the theoretical explanation of the procedures that he used in getting well. Hey, well, after the publication of One Answer to Cancer, things really started to happen. As you might imagine, the American Medical Association, the State Board of Dental Examiners, and a host of other health-oriented organizations began to get hostile. And he endured a great deal of persecution during that time, found himself in quite a dilemma. On one hand, the number of individuals seeking his help was ever increasing. On the other, charges of practicing medicine without a license were being leveled upon him. Eventually, he began seeing cancer patients for a living, started charging for his services. However, he saw only those people whose doctors had referred their patients to him. And he consulted with the individual as well as the physician involved, always working well within the law. As of 1985, when Kelly wrote this piece, the last count with which he was familiar, he had worked with over 33,000 patients by 1985. Kelly's caseload had always been predictably lopsided. And until recently, the only patients who came to him did so after being advised that there was nothing left to do but buy their burial plots and make out their wills. They had tried everything else before coming to see him. It's pretty amazing he was able to save any of them at all. A great many of those early patients were alive and well. Keep in mind, Kelly's own situation exploded in 67 and 68. By 1985, at the time Kelly wrote this, there were many people still alive and well, singing his praises to anyone who would listen. And in the cases of those who he was not able to save, their quality of life was still drastically improved. Many who succumbed to their illnesses did so without the reality-distorting drugs that they once took for pain relief. And noting this, many of their relatives became vocal supporters of her father's work as well. Dad, she continues, had helped blaze a trail. He'd been a genuine pioneer in his field. I think the phrase health food nut must have been coined specifically to describe him. Difficult now to remember how far out his concepts were considered in 1969. Just as women today take for granted the rights their forerunners worked so hard to win, it's easy to forget that Dad preached health foods and ecology long before it became chic to do so. And when Kelly was growing up, many of her friends asked her why she never had acne at all. She was too embarrassed to tell them. She said, "I must admit I'm shocked to see things that I was forced to consume and use to hide frantically, such as granola or carrot juice. Not only socially acceptable, but became socially desirable." When friends would come over to play with Kelly and her sisters, there were no snacks that we felt comfortable offering them. Oh, there was food in the house, to be sure, but nothing they might recognize. The milk in the refrigerator was raw goat's milk. Well, they had a goat in the backyard. That by itself caused a great deal of comment. Kelly's mother milled wheat to make her own flour to bake her own bread. Instead of sugar, the sweetener their family used was blackstrap molasses. Carol brownies are terrific, but if I offered them, I'd have to explain that chocolate was not allowed in our house. People thought her parents were crazy. Kelly didn't particularly disagree at that point in time. But moreover, it wasn't just that we ate differently, Kelly continues. Dad used the members of our family as guinea pigs to check out every new theory he came across in his research. For instance, he had all the silver fillings taken out of her mouth and replaced with gold. Oh, there'd been quite a bit of silver in there, so the procedure took a long time. It was very expensive. Kelly didn't understand why he wanted to do this, nor did she bother to ask for an explanation. "Nothing Dad did at that time made sense to my sisters or I," she says. "We just rolled our eyes and did as we were told." Just within the last year, she's heard the news that the composition of silver fillings changes over time, sometimes producing the same symptoms as does mercury poisoning. That's just one example out of hundreds. And Kelly continues to discover on a daily basis just how much ahead of his time her father had been. And now she can appreciate the courage it must have taken to adhere to the truths that he found. Kelly had never refused a patient. His philosophy was that where there's hope, there's hope. I'm sorry, where there's life, there's hope. And at a point, actor Steve McQueen came to him for help. Kelly did not turn him away, although he knew that accepting the man as a patient was actually very dangerous. McQueen had at that time, rare form of cancer, mesothelioma, which in most cases is quite fatal. Again, he'd been told to get his affairs in order by every physician he had seen. They offered him, McQueen, no hope. All the medical community could offer McQueen was a short delay of the inevitable by using surgery and chemotherapy. Well, McQueen was not unlike the rebel and the fighter he portrayed on screen. Rejecting the concept of lying in a hospital bed, passively awaiting death, he preferred to fight to live, even in the face of odds that no one could deny. And as well, he had seen his friends, John Wayne, undergo the procedures the doctors recommended. He wanted no part of the slow, painful mutilation that held no hope of survival. And the last thing anyone involved wanted was that the story of McQueen's illness and subsequent treatment be leaked to the press. McQueen himself did not want the public to know he was ill. The people surrounding him did not want the star to be linked with the controversial treatment he's receiving. Kelly didn't want to go public with the famous patient whose chances of survival were so slim, because he knew that if he lost a patient of McQueen's stature, that particular death would be all the public would remember. and the lives he had saved would be overlooked entirely. But that bastion or bastard of American journalism, the National Enquirer, unearthed the story. And possessing an intense hatred for the tabloid, McQueen insisted that he'd be allowed to break the news before the Enquirer could go to press, because he wanted to tell his fans about his illness himself. Well, as we know, McQueen died November the 7th, 1980. Wow. That anniversary was yesterday. And all of this was from complications arising after surgery performed for the purpose of removing dead tumor masses. But the majority of the media never did get the story straight. They had a field day with Kelly. She says that she will never forget watching the Today Show and seeing her father sit there verbally brutalized by Tom Brokaw and Jane Pauley, watching him say virtually nothing in his own defense. He had known the probable outcome of the situation, took the abuse as if it were in his due. In reality, all he had done was try to the best of his ability to help another human being who had no other avenue open. Now, Tom Snyder gave him a fair hearing, and so did several others. But such was the exception, not the rule. Kelly received a great deal of unexpected support from his old patients and their relatives, though. And Kimberly will never forget that either. He was swamped. Dr. Kelly was swamped with their calls, their letters, their gifts. They stood up to be counted, but unfortunately, no one really cared about the lives that Dr. Kelly had saved. For Steve McQueen was dead. Kimberly worked with her father at the International Health Institute, a privately owned foundation which conducted research in natural healing. And when people would call there and discovered that her last name was Kelly, she was in for an earful of praise for her father. They would launch into an hour-long dissertation about how wonderful Kelly was and how his work improved or saved lives of loved ones. He said it seemed to be very important to these callers that Dr. Kelly's daughter should understand and appreciate the magnitude of his work. They all take upon themselves the personal responsibility of informing her who he is, who her father is, and what he had done. And he would receive thousands of cards and presents every year from people he no longer remembered. But they remember him, and they were grateful for his help. But Kimberly concludes by saying, but no one is more grateful than I. My healthy childhood may have caused me a little embarrassment from time to time, but it stood her in good stead. Her father had taught her to search for truth, even if it means questioning what others readily accept. She said, I will always be thankful that my father had the insight to find the truth and the courage to say so. Signed, Kimberly S. Kelly, Dallas, Texas, 1985. When Kelly passed away, and several years later, we needed to begin printing books again. I've shared the story with you. We altered the title. The original book, One Answer to Cancer, had already had a modification some years later. It was called One Answer to Cancer. And I can't remember the rest of the title. I think it was like With Cancer Cure or something of that nature. And then in 2021, the book was retitled Cancer Cure and the Incurable Without Surgery, Chemotherapy, and Radiation. Now, that title didn't last very long because the Food and Drug Administration put a cease and desist for reasons I've shared with you before. You see, you can't cure cancer. You can only treat it. Interesting. The title of the book was changed to victory over cancer. Terminology that had been used in Kelly's book. And when I was approached about taking over publication of the book, John said, we're going to have to change the title. It took me a matter of 5 seconds to do that. Victory over cancer without surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. I am still the publisher of that book, but I made a decision that that which I've just shared with you would be included in that book. And it's published, as it should be. Let's talk a little bit about pancreatic cancer. And time may escape us here, because I had an area to go, a direction to go to kind of conclude this program. But let's talk a little bit about pancreatic cancer. We'll talk about the signs, the symptoms of it. Now, maybe you'll understand exactly why I chose to reshare that which we've just completed from Kimberly Kelly. Some people get cancer of the pancreas. Now, that's the organ in our abdomen that makes digestive enzymes and hormones such as insulin. The cancerous mass can interfere with the pancreas's function and lead to symptoms like stomach or back pain, jaundice, that's yellowed skin, diarrhea, nausea, weight loss, diabetes. Early in the disease, pancreatic cancer is typically asymptomatic, means it doesn't cause any symptoms. Symptoms from pancreatic cancer often begin gradually and intermittently, so people may dismiss them. And often by the time the symptoms are more significant, the cancer is already large or it has already spread. That makes it more difficult to treat. Oh, that's right. They can't say more difficult to cure. But not everyone with pancreatic cancer will have all these symptoms. Most people who have one of the symptoms have a different medical condition and not pancreatic cancer. Most people with pancreatic cancer, jaundice is one of the first symptoms. Jaundice refers to the yellowing of the skin and or the whites of your eyes. It occurs when there's some sort of a buildup of bile, a substance made in the liver that helps break down fats. And normally bile travels from the liver to the gallbladder and out through the intestines and the feces. If you don't know the word feces, it's impolitely pronounced poop. But since the pancreas is located nearby, a pancreatic mass may block the flow of bile, leading to jaundice. It can also cause your skin to become itchy and your urine to turn dark brown. If the mass is located in a specific spot, this might happen before the pancreatic cancer is advanced. But sometimes pancreatic cancer can also cause jaundice because the cancer has already spread to the liver. Now, in people over 40, new jaundice carries a cancer risk of over 20%. Now, that figure includes not just pancreatic cancer, but other kinds of cancer as well. And yet many other different medical conditions can also cause jaundice and related symptoms. Stomach, back pain. Upper stomach pain is another common symptom of pancreatic cancer. Because of the anatomy of the pancreas, which is found on the back side of your abdomen, back pain is also relatively common. And the pain may tend to be worse after meals. And yet most people who have stomach pain and or back pain usually have it from other causes. Some of the other symptoms, nausea, vomiting, weight loss. Very common symptoms of pancreatic cancer. The cancer may press up against the stomach, which can make vomiting worse. Unintended weight loss from poor appetite, decreased food intake is also quite common. And then there's changes in your bowel habits. Pancreatic cancer sometimes causes diarrhea, which may be due to decreased pancreatic digestive enzymes. And yet other people with pancreatic cancer may notice constipation instead. Stools that appear greasy are particularly concerning. They might be a sign that bile and digestive enzymes aren't making it to the intestines to break down fat. And the stool may also be lighter in color instead of dark brown. But what about diabetes? Because most people with diabetes do not get pancreatic cancer, but it sometimes is the first sign of the disease. Damage to the pancreas can impair its ability to make insulin. And in some people, this leads to diabetes, which is characterized by consistently elevated glucose levels in the blood, high blood sugar. Diabetes from damage to the pancreas is sometimes called pancreatogenic type 3C diabetes. Diabetes might be picked up on a blood test without any initial symptoms. You may also notice symptoms of diabetes like excess thirst, hunger, urination. But diabetes isn't as common as some other symptoms of pancreatic cancer. Of people eventually diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, about 1 in 4 first receive a diagnosis of diabetes, believe it or not. But what about blood clots? People with some kinds of cancer, including pancreatic, are at risk of blood clots. And for some people, such blood clots are the first sign that they have pancreatic cancer. Often this occurs in one of the deep veins of the leg called the deep vein thrombosis, which can cause symptoms like leg pain, swelling, warmth. Sometimes such clots travel to the lungs, termed a pulmonary embolism, which can cause symptoms like chest pain and severe shortness of breath. If severe, it can be life-threatening. But there are symptoms in less common pancreatic cancer types. At least 90% of pancreatic cancers are classified as adenocarcinomas, and the symptoms described apply to them. And yet a small subset of people have other types of pancreatic cancer. And those rare types may have some of the same symptoms, or they may not cause symptoms at all. And yet they may also have additional specific symptoms. For example, insulinoma is an example of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, which can cause symptoms based on excess hormones produced. And an insulinoma might cause symptoms like irritability or headache from too much insulin, and might result in low blood sugar. We are trying to simplify all of this up with you. I don't want to get so in-depth. I also don't want to scare people. That's never my intent. We're here to talk to you about these things. Certainly, if you are concerned that you might have pancreatic cancer, you might want to make an appointment to see a healthcare provider quite soon, especially if you have a family history. Particularly important to do so if you are 60 or older and you have weight loss in addition to stomach or back pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, or new diabetes. Also important to see a health professional quickly if you have jaundice. Tell them you have jaundice when you call, because you're going to need to be evaluated promptly. Now just bear with me a second. If you should wind up with an appointment with a healthcare provider and you are diagnosed as a cancer victim, of course, they'll not use the term victim. I use it because that's what it is. There are some people that I can refer you to, people who were and have been very deeply involved with the Kelly program for many, 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 many years. Nick Gonzalez is no longer with us. but there are people with his organization that I can guide you with. I also have Dr. Curtis Kuhn, who I work very closely with, that I can connect you with. There are some other people, all fully trained in the Kelly program. I can be reached by a phone at 602-799-8214. That's 602-799-8214. I'm sorry. 602-799-8214. I can also be reached via email. Victory. Bear with me. I'm blanking. I go through this once in a while. Just hang on. Victory@drkelly.net. Victory@drkelly.net. I also might suggest that you seriously contemplate acquiring Dr. Kelly's books. If you've been diagnosed with cancer, his self-test book will not be of any help to you. But his cancer book, Victory Over Cancer, will be. I have two ways that you can order that. One is by mail order. Mail me a check, a money order, whatever works out. Or you can order it through PayPal. If you go to the Kelly website, it's simple to find. Up toward the top of the site, under the words, Dr. Kelly's Victory Over Cancer. If you drop your mouse down, you're on computer, hold the mouse over the words, the bookstore. If you're interested in Victory Over Cancer without surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, click on that, open it up. It'll give you a full description. I have to share with you that there are people that order the books that have not been diagnosed with cancer, but they're very interested in learning more about it. They want to learn about Kelly's work. They want to learn, and believe me, the book will lay a degree of responsibility on those who have been diagnosed with cancer. There's things you can do. There's things within our life that we must take control over and of. For those who've not been diagnosed that want to make darn sure that they stay healthier, yes, Dr. Kelly's self-test for the different metabolic types will help get you on a better diet for your body's needs. And that's what that's all about. If you want to get some better understanding of that prior to ordering a book, also on the website, Dr. Kelly's Victory Over Cancer, it's actually drkelly.net. Right below the title is the word home, welcome mission, Dr. William D. Kelly, his story, and right next to that, Dr. Kelly's metabolic typing. If you click on that link, you will get the entire written transcript of the self-test book, not the test, however. The entire written transcript, which may confuse you. It may also begin to answer some very interesting questions about your dietary issues and some of your own health issues. Whether they're related to cancer or not, it's not the issue. That's the whole point of it. The man set the mark in his work. And as I've stated before, the self-test book for the different metabolic type was stated by Price Pottinger is the greatest advancement in the field in 150 years. That's not change, people. Once again, questions, you can email me. You can phone me. Not at this hour of the night, please. I've got to eat, do some other things, you know. my goodness gracious. Michael, I have a quick question for you. And no, I'm not going to have time to dance with Kim tonight. Are we cool with my releasing this information with the program change? Can we do that yet or no? We still kind of on hold with that. Just hang on, folks. I'm just waiting for an answer. Go ahead. It's posted on the website now. Hot dang. I haven't had a chance to get there, man. December 5th, 2023, we're going to be making some changes to our program. The hour that you currently are listening to The Edge of Darkness, etc., oh, I had to look at that. It threw me for a second. The Edge of Darkness and this program we do on Wednesday nights called To Health With You or Your Health, Your Choice, whatever. We're going to be making some changes. Beginning on the 5th of December, I will no longer be broadcasting in this time slot. We're going to be going on the air with a two-hour program Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And we'll be coming on, what, 2 hours earlier, I guess? I not having it in front of me, I'm fried, man. So anyway, if you go to the website Republic Broadcasting Network, there's an update on the schedule information. And we'll begin having a post on our websites, letting you know about the changes in the programming. And we'll be doing a two-hour set each night, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. But like I say, we'll be coming on earlier. I'll be coming on 3 hours earlier than the current program. I'm sorry. I'll be coming on from 4 to 6 p.m. Central Time, which means 3 to 5 Mountain Time. And that also means 4 to 5, like, what, 6 to whatever. You got it all figured out. Anyway, I'll get my head together here. Let me, my dog is going absolutely nuts tonight. What the heck is her problem? Minnie Mouse. Naomi Wolf. Interesting gal. Until the COVID era, she was, quote, a well-known feminist nonfiction writer for 35 years. Privileged to be part of the cultural scene made up of influencers on the progressive left. With great courage, however, she rejected masks, lockdowns, and vaccines urged upon us by the state. She viewed them as totalitarian impositions upon us, and her heroic stance turned her into a non-person. Her friends and her associates on the left shunned her. As a result, Naomi Wolf has rethought her political alliances. She now finds herself in the company of conservatives and libertarians. I'm going to share a little bit with you about her story, some of her insights about COVID. Focus a little bit on how she sees the world now. Her study of English literature, in which field she holds a doctorate from Oxford, led her to challenge masks and lockdowns. And she said, I knew from having read my way as a former graduate student through many of the last 400 years' words of English memoirs and novels, that waves of infectious diseases ranging from yellow fever to typhus to cholera had passed over both Britain and America, but that those diseases had never been treated as we were treating this purportedly serious infectious disease, COVID-19. Never had multiple generations been advised to crowd together into closed indoor spaces only to be denied light and air and exercise during an epidemic. And from Florence Nightingale and the Crimean War to the reformers of the progressive era, health pioneers knew well that doing that was, in fact, deadly. Now, friends, the vaccines, as we know, were even worse. Wolf viewed them as genocidal in that they adversely affected women's reproduction. A group of 3,250 doctors and scientists and other experts organized by Wolf analyzed documents secured by court order from Pfizer, one of the two main producers of the COVID vaccine. And the findings were devastating. Naomi continues by saying, I'm not saying that this is exactly like finding evidence of Dr. Mengele's experience. I'm saying that now, with these findings, the comparison is not excessive. These anti-humans at Pfizer, speaking at the WEF, these anti-humans at the FDA, knowing what they knew, targeted the miraculous female body with its ability to conceive and gestate and birth and nurture life. They targeted the female body's ability to sustain a newborn human being with nothing but itself. And they targeted the human fetus' very environment, one of the most sacred spaces on this earth, if not the most sacred, and they knew it. How was Wolf able to arrive at these insights when many other well-educated and informed people failed to do so? A vital clue to answering this question surprisingly lies in what she said about color perception. Naomi Wolf says, our Western modern culture insists that only phenomena that we can see and explain are real, and that human perception must be contiguous and must universally be the same. But what if that's not true? Could people have actually seen differently than we do in former times? Cognitive scientists are confirming that this different color palette could be a real thing caused by differences in language practices. They're finding that if a culture does not have language to describe a thing, the brain does not perceive it as clearly, or sometimes not at all. Wolf has got amazingly keen powers of perception, my friends, and has been able to perceive things most others cannot. And she continued that ever since I was first conscious, I was aware that I perceived some things differently than did many of those around me. She says that she realized in kindergarten, without, of course, having the word for this, that I had synesthesia, the condition in which one sense spills over into another. People with that form of perception hear colors, they taste sound, or in other ways, activate different senses at the same time. And though she managed to censor her synesthesia, her awareness as a child, that perception was fluid. And that currents of all kinds were continually flowing all around us. And that the physical world was illuminated and glowing and magical, but also that it contained dark and scary forces which could not be suppressed. My friends, we sit here now in a position to grasp the relevance of these philosophical considerations to Wolf's account of COVID. She sensed that a cosmic struggle was occurring, and it became essential to take sides in it. And that she had certainly done. She reluctantly concluded that human agency alone could not coordinate a highly complicated set of lies about a virus and propagate the lies in perfect uniformity around an entire globe, in hundreds of languages and dialects. Human beings, using their own resources alone, could not have turned hospitals overnight from having been places in which hundreds of staff members were collectively devoted to the care of the infirm, the prolongation of human life, the cherishing of newborns, the helping of mothers to care for little ones, the support of the disabled, and turn it all into killing factories to which the elderly were prescribed as run death is near. At scale. Is she correct in her account of the world? I do not presume to say. The skeptics, the attitude that Immanuel Kant took to the visions of Emanuel Swedenborg may come to mind, but Swedenborg was not without his eminent defenders. Wolf's vision of the world has certainly energized her for battle. Even those who do not accept it or her must recognize her solid empirical work she has about the dangers of this damn vaccine. Oh, and here we sit. I mean, come on. It's another year, and they're out there wanting to poke us again. Oh, they're not so much pushing the words COVID. They're just, they want us to take the vaccine. Come on. You can read about it. You can see it. It's out there all over the place. But she stirringly calls each and every one of us to battle. And these words I share with you. Freedom, my friends, is not free, as many veterans have said. She said, I never understood what that meant, except superficially. But you don't get freedom back so easily if you yourself committed massive crimes. Freedom is not free. You don't get to take away the freedom of others and enjoy it without penalty for yourselves. The people you harmed, the parents of the children you burned, they're coming. Not violently, not vengefully, but with the righteous sword of justice in hand. Don't rest easy, leaders who did wrong, in this bright American sunlight, because you don't get America back as if nothing had happened. This is an unusual commentary. I'd like to say we owe a great debt of gratitude to this heroic fighter for freedom. She's learned the lessons. She's done a 90 degree, 180, 160 degree, whatever. And the more I read, the more I study, the more I continue to get involved with this stuff from a health standpoint. I mean, I've got two other pieces that I've come to. Bayer has faced a $170 million verdict in another Roundup cancer lawsuit. Bayer has been directed to pay $1.25 million in another Roundup cancer lawsuit out of St. Louis, Missouri. This is unbelievable. And yet somehow, some way, they managed to drag it all out. They don't necessarily pay it off. Maybe they'll set up a separate corporate entity down in North Carolina where they can stretch it out even further and further and further. And yet look at the poisons they continue to want us all to take. We'll have some more things we're going to be posting. By the way, if you didn't know, Bayer, of course, in 2018 acquired Monsanto Company. We're dealing with that. There's another profound story that I've come across regarding our boy Fauci. Fauci's story gets deeper and deeper and deeper, my friends. It is simply profound. The things that this guy has been involved with. He knew this was coming. He was a part of it. Do you understand that? We, the people, have been poisoned. Of course, you know, Bill Gates will take care of all that. He's going to give us plastic food. A lot of those people are all involved with this mess. A lot of these people are involved with this mess. I shared with you the story the other night about surrendering U.S. sovereignty to who? The World Health Organization. Another step, another bit of control. My goodness, we're out of time. Wow. Hey, thanks for being with us. I'll be back with you tomorrow night. Another installment of The Edge of Darkness. Until that time, with glass lifted on high, I say, to health with you. Good night. Brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars and down by the shore an orchestra's playing. And even the palms seem to be swaying.
they begin the beginning to live it again is past all endeavor, except when that tune clutches my heart. Divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean. So
Bolton for Ease Off. I know so many of you are finding our Easy 4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.